But it shows a worrying sign and a worrying trend when we see that the president...
Good evening. This is the Voice of America in Washington. Welcome to another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'm Douglas Mpuga. This evening, we'll talk about the failing South Sudan peace talks. And with us tonight is Dr. Jock Madut Jock. He's a co-founder of the Sword Institute. He's also a professor in the Department of History at Loyola Marymount University in California. Good afternoon, Dr. Jock.
Thank you, Douglas. Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. And joining us also is momentarily is Maji El Gizuli. He's a fellow at the Rift Valley Institute. The Rift Valley Institute is a nonprofit research and training organization working with communities and institutions in East Africa, including Sudan and the Horn. Dr. Gizuli is joining us from Germany. I think we don't have him yet, but he'll be joining us momentarily. We also have our regular panelist, Suleiman Mugula. He's joining us from Durban, South Africa, as usual. He's an independent political analyst. Good afternoon, Mr. Suleiman.
Good afternoon, Douglas, and the listeners.
And welcome to the show once again.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're welcome. As you may have heard, the South Sudan's government has failed to sign to a peace agreement to end almost 2 years of fighting in the country, despite securing substantial gains at the negotiating table. Two of the three parties the negotiating signed up to the latest agreement. These were an amalgamation of rebel fighters known as the Sudan South Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition and the former detainees SPLM-FD, a group of 10 men arrested by the government in the early days of the conflict and later released. Now, but the government, though, refuses to sign because of a clause involving the withdrawal of its army from Juba. Now, let's start from there. Mr. Jock, what are you hearing from your neck of the woods? What's going on in Juba? Is there a chance that the government of Silva Kiir may sign up to this agreement?
Well, Salva Kiir went back to Juba from Addis Ababa on the 18th with the promise that he will return after 15 days of consultation with the people there and with his government. But 2 days ago, after a phone call from U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, Salva Kiir is reported to have said that he is going to be signing this agreement in the next few days. So that is really what is making people's heads spin at the moment, because on the one hand, it sounds like a promising development, but on the other hand, it is very difficult to see how Salva Kiir's government and supporters of his government will accept the signing of this peace agreement, because it to them it means that the country is basically being handed over partly to the opposition and partly to the international community, and that is something a lot of people don't want to accept, issues of sovereignty and freedom and such.
So is that the reason why the withdrawal of the government troops from Juba so important?
The demilitarization of the capital and other three other towns, state capitals in Greater Upper Nile, is one of the clauses in this proposed compromise agreement, something that a lot of the government supporters object to entirely.
I see.
So that was the main reason why the president decided not to sign this peace agreement.
I see. I'm told we have Maji El Gizuli, a fellow at the Rift Valley Institute. Welcome to the show, Mr. Gizuli.
Thank you very much.
I'm sorry you're joining us a little bit, but we just kicked off the program. And we're talking about the delay by the Silver Cape government to sign on the agreement. First of all, before I bring in Suleiman, Gizuli, comment on the reluctance of the Silver Cape government initially to sign on because citing the withdrawal of his troops from the capital Juba.
Well, I don't really think that's the ultimate reason. I think the ultimate reason is the perception of President Key that there is a rift in the ranks of the opposition. I mean, in the ranks of the rebel movement led by Riek Machar. And my feeling is that he supposes that this might be an opportunity to make greater gains than what he has done so far. Mm. And he feels if he waits long enough, he might be able to get a better bargain. Mm. So my feeling is that this, although of course the reasons he puts forward are relatively strong, I think ultimately it's about an investment in the future where he might militarily have an upper hand.
I see. Suleiman, there are those, some analysts have pointed out the irony of Silver Cape's government citing issues of sovereignty as one of the reasons why they didn't want to concede removing troops, demilitarizing the capital Juba. But then in the same capital Juba, there are foreign troops, the Ugandan troops there mainly. I mean, is that not an irony?
Definitely, without doubt. And over and above, we have also to consider the history of the region. The region has got a history of dishonesty. You remember very well that the current government of President Museveni came into power after an agreement similar to this one. In December 1985, there was a peace agreement between the rebels then Museveni, and then the former government of the military junta. After signing the agreement, Museveni went behind the back and took over the government. Again, remember, in Rwanda before the genocide, the negotiations were still going on. As RPF was approaching the capital, goes around and takes over the capital. The same situation in DRC, the same situation in Burundi. So the area, the region has got quite a number of dishonest leaders who have been rebels at one time or the other. That is why you find there is a lot of skepticism on many of them. So it is not only being afraid of the sovereignty as such, but there is also a historical part of it that some of them are afraid, Salva Kiir is afraid, that he might be done what Museveni did to the rebels, what the RP did to Habyarimana, and so on. So there is a lot of politicking within the area in addition to the local politics within Juba itself.
Yeah, let me throw that question, that point you raised, Suleiman, to the rest of the panel. Dr. Jok, are the parties involved signing out of goodwill and trust, or is it because of the pressure that's being exerted from outside?
Well, on the side of the rebels and the opposition parties, I think they are signing because they see something positive for them in the agreement. But for the government, they see this process has gone badly. The reason why the Juba government actually agreed to go to Addis was that they thought the proposed compromise agreement was a negotiating document, not a done deal, that people would sit around and negotiate around it. But they arrived there, and what they found was that they were being pressured to sign a document which was drafted by the people in the region and in the international community. And I think this is what this is a valid point that Juba government is making, that instead of impose an agreement, let us sit and discuss this agreement and reach areas of compromise and work out areas of disagreement. Start with the soft issues that do not have a lot of disagreement over, such as compensation for the victims, such as interim justice for and accountability for war crimes, such as reconstruction fund. There are not a lot of disagreement on these issues. So why not start with confidence-building measures and then move on to the most difficult ones, such as security arrangement and power sharing? But now power sharing has overshadowed everything else, including some of the drivers of violence in the country. It means that the parties are focusing on power sharing and less so on the peace itself.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Gizuli, do you envisage a situation where a deal, an agreement brokered and designed and put down by other parties, not the parties that are at war, can it take root and be successful?
Well, the straightforward answer to your question is no, of course. It's very unlikely. I mean, there is a record of agreements already and they got between the two parties over the past year. They've signed several ceasefire agreements, because there was no basis for them, they didn't hold, because there wasn't any settlement. I must, however, diverge with Jock on one issue, that power sharing is at the heart of this dispute. So you might approach it softly or not softly, but ultimately this is the crashing point. You might delay it, but eventually you have to face up to that. The ultimate cause of this dispute is a power dispute between two blocs.
Mm-hmm.
So as I see it, the issue of power sharing can't be walked around. Of course, what the IGAD is proposing is just a division of spoils. For the likes of Jock, you might propose something more democratic than that, than a division of spoils. But ultimately, this is at the heart of this matter.
Yeah, but Mr. Gizuli, the point is, this is a unique situation in that the parties that once shared power before, and then fell out, and then went to war. So how difficult or how easy is that to attain?
Well, it's obviously very difficult. Otherwise, we could have already had an agreement. As you can see, both parties are sort of hoping that they might achieve some military advantage that would give them greater leverage at the table. Of course, the intense pressure from above is not helping much, because as things are with these deadlines that come up every few months, you're pushing the two parties into some sort of settlement where none of them are actually objectively convinced. On this occasion, it appears that the opposition is more keen on an agreement and the government isn't. But as you can see, there's already a rift in the opposition around the agreement itself. And several commanders have decided that they are outside of this game altogether. And some are already demanding to be included in a comprehensive process, whatever that is, that involves everybody, including the splitting groups. So my fear is this is going to expand further with this logic of splits.
Mm-hmm. Jock, what's so unique about this arrangement that was not there in the previous agreements they signed?
Well, in my view, the only thing that is different is the degree of cohesiveness of the international community, the Troika, the UN, the African Union, and the IGAD countries seem to be speaking with one voice for once on the need to pressure the South Sudanese leaders to prioritize peace and to basically shame the leaders that it should be the international community that is showing concern for the lives of South Sudanese instead of the South Sudanese leaders themselves. So I think that is what is different. Other than that, the divergence from the way peace talks have always been organized in South Sudan and in the region, which is that the parties themselves are the ones who propose their positions, and then they sit and negotiate and reach agreement and close gaps, has been abandoned in this case in favor of a document drafted by outsiders.
Mm-hmm. Suleiman, some members of IGAD have their own vested interest. What role do you think they will play in reaching an amicable agreement?
It is a very difficult and very, very sensitive situation because, first of all, the instability in southern Sudan has got both security concerns for the country, because as the conflict heightens, it might go back into the old wounds. Remember that traditionally there has been a cleavage between, a division between Uganda and Southern Sudan have at one time been working, or been in one camp versus Northern Sudan, and you have Kony in Uganda on that one camp. So when it goes again, security-wise, we are running a situation where it might again go back into that wound and then create a security situation in the whole region. There is also the economic interest that many of these countries like Uganda, Kenya have been benefiting in this, in the New Southern Sudan. They have got a lot of trade interests there, so they are also being threatened. Thirdly, we don't know countries like Uganda. Uganda's hands have been all over. He has been a kingmaker. He worked in Rwanda, he worked in DRC, established a regime which has been there for close to 30 years. In Rwanda, it's a dictatorship there. In Burundi, he has got hands there. So some parties now are so skeptical and so suspicious about Uganda's role even in southern Sudan. So the involvement of Uganda is also another difficult element within the peace process, because some of the elements, some of the leaders in southern Sudan are so skeptical and suspicious about its interests, what the actual interests, why it had it rush into Juba and put forces there. As you can realize, the presence of those soldiers in Juba are themselves a divisive factor, and they are also a big problem as far as the peace process is. So the interests of the IGAD countries in the area also are putting stress on the whole peace process into the region.
I see. Well, gentlemen, hold your thoughts. Let's take a short break. We'll be back to continue our discussion of the peace process in South Sudan.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today, because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Dante AU, African Union, can these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this, whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Welcome back. In case you're just tuning in, you're listening to Reporters Roundtable, and we are coming to you live from the studios of VOA here in Washington. Our topic tonight is the South Sudan Peace Talks. Our panelists are Jock Madut Jock, co-founder of the SAD Institute. He's also a professor in the Department of History at Loyola Marymount University in California. Majid El Ghizouli, a fellow at the Rift Valley Institute, who is joining us from Germany, and Suleiman Mugula, the South African-based independent political analyst, and I'm your host, Douglas Simpuga, here in Studio 9. Now, gentlemen, the situation as the talks go on and people figure out how to get these parties to agree, the student situation seems to be deteriorating. Just days after South Sudan President Salva Kiir threatened to kill journalists for reporting what he called against the country, a journalist has been shot dead. Peter Moi was killed last night after leaving work in Juba. His body was found in the residential area of Korok. Moi had worked for the Cooperate newspaper. Oliver Modi, chairman of the Union of Journalists of South Sudan, called the killing intentional. Tom Rhodes, the South African correspondent for the Committee to Protect Journalists, and from Nairobi, he spoke with South Sudan in Focus reporter Ayen Bior about Moi's death.
It is rather foreboding, but it's too early to tell what has happened to Peter. But it shows a worrying sign and a worrying trend when we see that the president on Sunday afternoon threatening to kill journalists before departing to Addis. And then Wednesday night, a journalist is shot. Furthermore, my sources tell me that his mobile phone and money was still intact in his pocket, which would seem to suggest that the cause of death was not due to a robbery.
And Tom, your organization has listed South Sudan as the second deadliest country for journalists in 2015. In your own words, could you tell me how deadly is South Sudan?
The sad truth is it didn't used to be like this. It was quite a safe place to work. We had an incident in 2012, but this year we've had an unprecedented number of journalists killed. 5 in Western Baragazal State, 1 in Jonglei State, and now here in the capital in Juba. So the numbers speak for themselves that things are getting more and more dangerous for journalists. And my fear is that as political uncertainties continue with this ongoing peace process discussions and ongoing conflict, we're not going to see that trend changing anytime soon.
And Tom, I just wanted to get your opinion on what can be done to protect the lives of journalists in South Sudan.
For one, we need the government, and particularly the security forces, to adhere to their own laws and stop, you know, arbitrarily arresting and closing down media houses without any recourse to the law or the constitution, which protects press freedom. I mean, that would be probably the first step. Journalists themselves need to, you know, really consider their own security more in their reporting. You know, don't walk home alone, walk in a buddy system. Use sort of tactics for online communication, secure online communication. There's a lot that we could all do to prevent these kind of tragic incidences happening in the future.
That was Tom Rhodes, the South African representative for the Committee to Protect Journalists, and from Nairobi spoke with South Sudan in Focus reporter Ayen Bior. Gentlemen, let me begin with a joke in California. As it's been 2 years now since the conflict began, things are broken down, especially security.
Yeah, but security has always been broken. It was considered by the citizens of South Sudan as the biggest and most anticipated peace dividend after the ending of the North-South War and after the independence, because you will recall that long before this conflict erupted, violence was engulfing the country in 7 states out of the 10 states in the Union. Whether it took criminal violence or it is politically motivated violence or cattle rustling or what have you, violence had been a characteristic of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no question that, of course, it has worsened with the current conflict. Not just in terms of outright direct military confrontation, but also in terms of targeted attacks on individuals because of their position or their conscience. And this is happening from all sides of the conflict, not just the government, not just the opposition, but all sides of the conflict. Violence that is politically motivated, but also taking ethnic lines or taking the divide, the political divide between the opposition and the government.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no question that that violence and that has really increased, and security has declined a great deal. And this is one of the points that I wanted to make about the current focus on things to do with power sharing. And while I agree that power is at the center of the conflict, focusing on just dividing power and the spoils as a backbone of the peace agreement is simply not going to bring peace to the people of South Sudan.
Mr. Gizuli, have things responded to Jock's point there? Also, do you think things have broken so much that may be difficult to patch the country back together?
Well, I wouldn't say it might be difficult to patch the country. That's too aggressive a statement. I think there's always a future.
Mm-hmm.
But Jock's remark is absolutely correct, of course. I mean, violence is not a novelty in post-secession South Sudan or in pre-secession South Sudan. And probably this speaks to the challenges of the country more than anything else. On the other hand, it also speaks to the failure of the administration of the SPLM to bring that promised peace based on secession, based on the post-secession government, on the management of politics in South Sudan. What happens is that politics in South Sudan has gone totally amok, and the SPLM has failed to bring that back together and failed to deliver on its major promises. And it's very, very ironic to see SPLM figures cycling in and out of government, today as former detainees, tomorrow as secretary generals, and so on. It's terribly ironic in a situation where nothing changes except their position. So violence continues, civilians continue to suffer, journalists are getting killed, and the only thing that's happening in the country is an alternation of chairs. So it is probably on the larger picture of things. The deficit is in the SPLM, the SPLA, and it is for the South Sudanese to look at this issue with more precision and think for themselves what is the future they'd like to have. This is not going to come from an EGAD process, obviously. And of course, Jock is totally right. A mere division of spoils is not going to alter the mode of politics in South Sudan. It just maintains or entrenches it. But the EGAD and the international community has nothing else to offer. I mean, the whole idea of liberal peacemaking is based on this premise, is that you bring the two partisans and you deal out some sort of power wealth-sharing arrangement. This is what the mediators can offer. It is up for the parties and up to other South Sudanese to come with alternative visions for their country. And my feeling is that as things stand, we will continue to see some level of insecurity. It will increase or decrease depending on the political temperature in South Sudan for some time, until that moment where there is an alternative political dispensation to the type of power arrangement that the SPLM has entrenched in post-secession in South Sudan.
In a very few seconds, before I leave you, Mr. Gizuli, what do you see happening if and when Mr. Kiir signs this deal? What happens in the following week, the following month?
Well, of course, on a hopeful note is that this will bring peace, but my fear is that somebody else will carry arms. I mean, obviously, I think the split that we see now in opposition is terribly underrated, but I think it's a pattern that we've seen before. Commanders unsatisfied with a particular arrangement walking out of a peace process and saying we will continue to fight. Mm-hmm. This happened also after secession. There were commanders who were unhappy, who remained in the wild, who maintained their guns, who maintained their militias, and Kiir's approach at the time towards these people was a big tent policy. Now, we might see an agreement, we might see an arrangement, but we might also just go back to the type of violence that predominated in South Sudan prior to the major outbreak of conflict in the previous year. So the type of violence that Jock was alluding to when we talked about insecurity in 7 out of 10 states.
Jock, the same question, very briefly, the same question. What is happening in the next weeks or months after the signing?
Well, very little indeed. I mean, they're talking about a 90-day pre-interim period to try to canton the armies and so forth. It depends on what is in the letter of that agreement. I think obviously everybody in South Sudan needs peace, and what they need is a political settlement at the top, so that it allows for ordinary communities and groups of people to organize some kind of reconciliation between these communities. And that is what they need. I mean, it's a non-state program of reconciliation and building of ethnic relations that have been destroyed in this conflict is what I imagine would be very important in the minds of a lot of people in South Sudan.
I see. Suleiman, we're out of time. Are you optimistic about the coming deal or not?
Not very optimistic, because from the beginning, the SPLM squandered the chance to build a nation.
Okay.
It should have used the South African template, not to use the hopeless template of Uganda, DRC, and Rwanda.
I see.
If they had wanted, they should have built institutions which would have backed up and established a democratic state, not a hopeless state which they have run into.
Thank you very much. We're out of time. Let's wrap up this edition of Reporters Roundtable. I'd like to thank our panel, Jock Madut-Jock, co-founder of the SAD Institute and a professor at the Department of History at Loyola Marymount University in California, Mr. Maji Al-Gizuli, a fellow at the Rift Valley Institute, and Suleiman Mugula, independent political analyst based in South Africa. Gentlemen, thanks very much for being on the show. Our producer was Jackson Mufunganyi, and our engineer tonight was Peter Handley. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Reporters Roundtable. I remain, in case you missed any part of this program, you can still get on the website. Thanks very much for tuning in. And until next week, I'm your host, Douglas Impuga, in Washington, wishing you all the best.
Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after.